This week on the Best of Flashpoints, we feature senior producer Nora Barrows-Friedman reporting from the occupied West Bank of Palestine. Nora is focusing in particular on the devastating impact that illegal occupation is having on children and young people. Also, we'll feature Flashpoint's environmental reporter, Amanda Bellery, with an update on the Canadian Church and State's attempted genocide against Native peoples of Canada. Also, students across California speak out against deep and destructive budget cuts.
The church knows where our children are buried. 50,000 died.
Kevin Annett is a community educator and minister in the downtown Eastside neighborhood of Vancouver, BC. He's the author of Hidden from History, The Canadian Holocaust, and he's also made an astounding award-winning documentary film called Unrepentant, Kevin Annett and Canada's Genocide. He joins me here in the Co-op Radio Studios in downtown Vancouver. Kevin, welcome to Flashpoints and Pacifica Radio.
Thank you for having me.
So how did these residential schools get set up? And how was it that parents had to let their children go into these schools?
Well, it was operating all through the 1800s. The Catholic Church especially had these mission schools where they would bring in Native kids and, quote, make them good Christians. And what happened in around 1890 is the Canadian government stepped in and authorized the creation of these schools. So they had government money backing them and legitimacy. All of the churches were involved, all the main Catholic and Protestant churches. So we're talking Anglican, that'd be like the Episcopalian Church in the U.S., the United Methodist Presbyterian Catholics, they're all running it. What it was a model that the Catholic Church had used for centuries all over the world, where they went in, they identified the chiefs who could be converted, and they used those chiefs against their own people. And there's stories right here in Vancouver of Chief Capilano, who's a traditional Squamish chief, describes how in the 1920s, the RCMP and the priest went into the longhouse and threw his grandfather out into the snow one night, literally. And they moved in a Catholic native chief. And to this day, the chiefs on the Squamish Reserve are the descendants of the ones that they had parachuted in. So they displaced the traditional chiefs, the clan mothers, and their whole traditional way of thinking and acting and their laws, and they brought in Christian Indians. And that was used as the model for what they did in the residential schools. So in effect, these were like theocratic dictatorships under the control of a priest with government sanction. And basically, the churches had absolute carte blanche to do whatever they wanted. The churches were made the legal guardians of these kids in the 1930s. So the native parent had to sign away guardianship rights of their own kids to the church, to the principal of the school. You know, the Indian agent would come around maybe once a year, maybe a couple of times a year, but I've found letters even where Indian agents describe how they had to look the other way when children died. But this was run by the church, and they didn't want to, you know, upset the church by looking too deeply into this. So it was officially a jointly run system, but in practice it was completely dominated by the churches, and the principals were invariably clergymen. I asked him why there were no Native people in the church, because I'd only been in Port Alberni a month. I got up in the pulpit every Sunday and looked out, and there was this lily white congregation in an area that was one-third Native. I knew that the United Church had had some relationship with the Native people. I didn't know anything about the residential schools. So I just asked Danny why they weren't in church. And he looked at me, you know, like almost insulted. And then he was looking out the window at the old residential school, and he said, "My best friend's buried in the hill out there, because they killed him in the school, and church people know about it, and they don't want us there." And I invited people to get up on Sundays and just tell their stories, which caused quite a interesting reaction among some of the older white people who would get up and stalk out, because these people were related to the ones who would run the residential school, the old missionary families and that. That, and also having to do a lot of funerals of young Native people, a lot of teenage suicides, started asking people, you know, where is this coming from? Because it's such a huge phenomenon in the Native world. And invariably, it was traced back to the fact that their parents, who had gone through the residential schools, didn't know how to be a parent. They didn't know how to love. All they knew how to do was how to hit and abuse their own kids, because that's what had happened to them. When you take away people's identity and their land and their language, and take away their family and the love from there, what do you have left? There's nothing left.
In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Flashpoint senior producer Nora Barrows-Friedman is back in the West Bank reporting on occupied Palestine. She joins us now from Bethlehem, and she is working on a series of reports for Pacifica Flashpoints and the electronicintifada.net. Nora, it is good to have you back on the ground, and it's good to have you back on the Flashpoints from Ground Zero. Why don't you begin by just giving us a little sense of, say, what you notice now as you go back for, you know, one of many visits. I'm sure you notice changes. You sense the atmospheric pressure. Talk about that.
Well, hi, Dennis. It's really good to be back here. And yeah, this is my seventh year now of going back and forth to the West Bank and seeing situations go from bad to worse to even worse. And, you know, it's been about 11 months since I've been here. And there are some changes, but there are a lot of kind of worsening of the changes that have already been made in the past, you know, few decades. The apartheid wall here, you know, in the West Bank is continuing to be built against international law, of course. The settlements, the colonies, you know, here in the Jerusalem, Bethlehem area are still expanding enormously. You know, the cranes, the tractors, the bulldozers are working day and night, also against international law, also against the, you know, the kind of this slap on the wrist, you could say, by the Obama administration, who has essentially given up even talking to the Israeli government about stopping these settlement expansions. And we're seeing home demolitions and invasions of villages, invasions of the refugee camps still happening on a daily basis. You know, I've just been here for a few days, just kind of soaking up the atmosphere and talking with people and trying to get a sense of you know, what is new here, what's going on, what's getting worse, what's getting better, if anything. And it's you know, really frustrating for people here to see absolutely nothing changing for the better and things just continuing to get worse and worse. A few days ago, I went to visit a man who lives by himself on this hillside in a village called Al-Walaja. And Al-Walaja was ethnically cleansed in 1948, beginning in 1948. And two-thirds of the village was usurped and stolen by Israel as it expanded the borders of Jerusalem and swallowed up most of the village and you know, after depopulating it in 48. And now that village is off limits to Palestinians in this area. Most of them from that village now live in Dehesha refugee camp. But I went to visit a man who was kind of the last holdout of that village in that area. There are still some Palestinian houses and people living in them nearby, but they are facing you know, regular home demolitions and military orders restricting them from movement and from you know, expanding their own houses. And this man is kind of sandwiched by these two settlement colonies. There's Gilo and then there's Har Gilo. And he's by himself. He's because he can't build a house on that land, which has belonged to his ancestors for countless generations. He has set up refuge inside of a cave that's about 4,000 years old, the Canaanite era cave. And he has planted all sorts of vegetables and fruits. He has chicken coops. He has rabbits. And he's basically making you know, making that land you know, usable for himself and for the community. But he is facing down an extraordinary amount of pressure and attacks by the Israeli police services who are protecting extremist settlers who want to build a new settlement on that land and take the rest of Al-Walaja village. They want to turn it into a settlement colony called Givat Ya'el, which is going to connect the two Gilo settlements on either side of the hill, and also expand that to connect with the larger Gush Etzion block, which stretches all the way south of Bethlehem. And, you know, he's been there for 15 years, facing attacks, regular attacks by both the Israeli police and the settlers. But he's there. He's gone to court. He has actual Israeli court orders that prove that this is his land. But, you know, all of these legal you know, moves are kind of null and void in the face of what Palestinians everywhere here in the West Bank and in Jerusalem are facing when it comes to these extremely empowered settler groups who have been empowered by countless, you know, Israeli administrations, but especially this new one, the Netanyahu administration, who has pretty much given settlers the directives to be foot soldiers for the Israeli government, motivations to take more and more Palestinian land and to contradict international law. And it's a very moving story, and it's also, you know, just a microcosm of what Palestinians here are facing on a daily basis, where, you know, they've been here, they have roots to this land, and they're facing, these catastrophic ethnic cleansing programs.
Well, and I was going to say, let me just jump in, Nora, and let people know you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Nora Barros-Friedman, our senior producer, on the ground again now, speaking to us from the West Bank in Bethlehem. And we're talking, I just jumped in when you used that word ethnic cleansing, because people are troubled when we accuse Israel of that, of genocide and ethnic cleansing. But this is the definition of it. You dehumanize the people, and then you take their resources and their land inch by inch. This is a classic description, and your anecdotal reporting is powerful because it's just consistent with so many things going on at the same time.
Yeah, and you know, when the Western establishment media covers, you know, this kind of story, whether they're talking about the Clinton going to talk with Netanyahu and you know, kind of feigning some sort of disdain at how quickly the settlement colonies are expanding, you know, there's never any human face on what that actually means. When settlements expand, it's not just they build and they grow. It's that they're actually taking other people's land. And this is not a new policy. This is a policy that is now in its 62nd year. And it's happened in broad daylight. It's a theft of an indigenous population's land and their resources and their freedom of movement and their human rights and all that is held dear under international law when it comes to protecting those things for all civilians around the world. And this is happening on a daily basis. I mean, it's not just Al-Walija. It's all of these, communities all over Palestine, and not just in the West Bank and Gaza, but it's happening inside the borders of Israel itself. I mean, on a weekly basis, there are home demolitions of Palestinians with Israeli citizenship inside, you know, villages, especially in the Negev Desert, where people are given absolutely no civil rights at all, where they don't have electricity or running water or schools or clinics, and they're forced time and time and time again on a regular basis out of their land, displaced for 3, 4, 5, 10 times in a single generation. And this is all happening, you know, with the full support of the United States and the European Union, and it just keeps getting worse. No one is stepping in to stop it.
All right. Well, let me. We don't have a lot of time, as usual. We're jamming, Nora. But there's another story that you're working on, and it has to do with children and young people in the context of this kind of deadly, draconian ethnic cleansing policy. Tell us about the 16-year-old you interviewed today, but he must have been 15 when he went to jail.
Well, actually, he just turned 17, so he was 15, 16 years old when he was arrested by the Israelis in the middle of the night. He's a boy from Dehesha refugee camp here in Bethlehem, where I've been working, you know, on and off for several years. He was actually a student of mine. We did journalism classes together, and he was, you know, kind of one of the best and the brightest, and a lovely young man with a lovely family. He has two brothers and two sisters, and you know, the whole family lives in Dehesha camp. And Dehesha, just to give people a 10% is over 12,000 people, 12,000 people in less than 1 square kilometer. So people are packed in. It's one of the largest refugee camps in the West Bank. And his story is also not an anomaly. It's a very common story. About a year and a half ago, he was sleeping with his family. It was 2 in the morning, and a battalion of Israeli soldiers surrounded the house, broke into the home, started smashing everything inside, and woke up all the children and the parents, and demanded that Muhammad, the boy's name is Muhammad, demanded that Muhammad come with them. And they told him that it was only going to be for half an hour, maybe an hour at most, and then they'd bring him back. But they needed to interrogate him because apparently, you know, he had been throwing stones, which under Israeli military law is pretty much equivalent to a federal offense, and it can land you, you know, up to 10 years in prison. And we're talking about children here. So they took Muhammad, they beat him on the way to the interrogation center, and then they transferred him to one of the largest and most infamous interrogation centers in Jerusalem. It's called the Muscovia Detention Center. And there he was held for 39 days under extremely torturous conditions. He was interrogated every single day. He was fed terrible food. He wouldn't see the light of day at all. He was kind of, this prison is most of the cells are underground, and so there's no light coming in. He didn't know what time it was. He didn't know when days would come after the next. And then after that, he was taken to Ofra prison, which is near Ramallah, which is also kind of an infamous, very large detention center and prison. And then after a couple of weeks, he was taken back to the interrogation center in Jerusalem, interrogated again, and then taken back to the prison where he spent the next 9 months not being able to even get, he wasn't even charged with anything. This is one of the other aspects that is just kind of an unbelievable part of this kind of treatment of children in particular, but the Palestinians who, you know, who regularly are faced with this kind of prison sentence. And so he was in what they call administrative detention, which we've talked about a lot on the show. No charges, no trial, no convictions, but kind of an indefinite sentence. After a year, he was brought back to his family. And, you know, and so I was talking with him about what that was like, and I also interviewed his parents. And, you know, his mother started to cry, and, she, you know, she said, look, you know, he was a boy, and he came back, and he has this experience, and now we all have to deal with this kind of trauma, and it happens to every single family in the camp. Everyone in the camp has someone in their immediate family who has been to jail, or who is in jail at the moment, or who has been killed by the Israeli military. And we're talking about children. I mean, this is it's a regular occurrence. For something as simple as throwing stones, Muhammad said that the Israelis wanted him to become a collaborator, which is something that they frequently do as well. They torture people, especially children, enough so that their spirit breaks and they agree to anything just to be able to get out of that condition. Muhammad is also, you know, he said he was also targeted for his political affiliations. He's affiliated with the PFLP, which is, you know, kind of the infamous, you know, Communist Party here in Palestine. And really this kind of treatment is, you know, exactly what I said. It's meant to break the will of people who are resisting this kind of occupation, who are resisting the fact that all freedoms here are restricted or taken away completely. You know, so this is life. This has been life for decades and decades here in Palestine. And
how can you describe how this affected this young man? What, how would you, as you listen to him and question him, is he intimidated? Is he angry? Is he being pushed underground?
No, you know, actually, he's a very strong-willed young man. And his mother said that after all of this, he's even gotten stronger. You know, this whole notion of, you know, breaking the will, it works some of the time, but mostly when especially children come back after this kind of torturous treatment and imprisonment, they come back, you know, ready to fight. And, you know, but I could tell, I mean, he's just a kid, you know, and, there was a sadness behind his eyes and in the way that he was telling the story. I mean, it was obviously traumatic. I mean, it can't not be traumatic for anybody. I think of my own child, and, you know, I can't imagine as a mother, as a parent, as you know, even, you know, someone who knows this young kid, I just wanted to put my arms around him and hug him. I mean, it's unbelievable. It's unimaginable what kind of pain this puts a family into. And it's a pain that keeps coming up again and again. I mean, I asked the mother, you know, you have three younger children. What do you fear for them? And she said, look, it could happen at any time. I don't know whether, you know, the 13-year-old that she has now, whether he'll be in prison in the next 2 years. It could happen. It most likely will happen. And there's nothing, you know, really that can be done. It's a part of life here. And people don't, you know, people don't have any recourse. There's nothing they can really do about it. I mean, what the Israelis do, they do, you know, with full support and backing from the United States, as I said. And you know, it's just going, this situation is just going from worse to even worse.
Well, that's Nora Barros-Friedman reporting on a part of life, a part of Palestinian life under occupation that you hear very little about, that has been essentially censored completely out of the U.S. mainstream press and much of European press. So, as always, we appreciate you being on the ground, Nora. We only have 30 seconds, but what else are you going to try and do for us and do some reporting on?
Well, there are a lot of things happening here. This prison and torture story of children is something that I'm going to be working on for probably the next week or so, in between, you know, other stories that kind of come up. There's a lot happening in Jerusalem right now in terms of home demolitions and the complete wiping out of entire villages and communities within occupied East Jerusalem, Palestinian communities, that I'm going to go investigate in the next few days. We'll, you know, I'm kind of taking it one day at a time to see where, you know, where I could be most effective in recording these stories and taking them back.
All right, Nora Barros-Friedman on the ground in occupied Palestine reporting for Flashpoints. Of course, we appreciate it. And this audience knows after 20 years of this show that this is a story that we will hold on to. We will counteract the mainstream, the big lie, the censorship, the fact that there is an ethnic cleansing, a genocide in motion. It has been sanctioned under the United Nations, and yet it's supported and funded heavily by the United States government. Nora, be careful. We'll talk to you soon.
Sounds good. Thanks, Dennis.
And you are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Again, spoke with Nora just before airtime, senior producer for this show, on the ground, reporting from occupied Palestine. Incredibly important story, and she's devoted her life to, and she puts herself at great risk, and she has learned Arabic so that she can report this story from many angles and talk to people where they work and live and report on a struggle that is really at the core of peace in this world. Again, I'm Dennis Bernstein. This is your daily investigative news magazine, Flashpoints. Coming up next, I'm very proud to present mighty powerful excerpts from a documentary, The People Speak. We featured a little bit of it before, but want to continue to honor Howard Zinn. So this is a marvelous documentary based on his book, Voices from his book, A People's History of the United States. Listen to this. You are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. We've got a studio full here of people who will be participating in tomorrow's statewide protests against these draconian cuts. Of course, we're covering California today, but we know that from coast to coast, it's the educational system and it's poor and working class people who are suffering. These community colleges are in jeopardy and the problems are beginning to mount as the cuts are instituted. So let's find out who's come in to talk to us, find out how people are going to participate tomorrow. And let's just sort of go around. I'd like it if you could introduce yourself, tell us how old you are, what school you're here from, and something about what you're going to do tomorrow.
Well, my name is Kevin, and I go to Fremont Federation. And one of the things that I'm willing to do tomorrow is march for my education, because it seems to be the most important thing in now in my life, now that I've suffered a few things, and, you know, we have struggles and all, but I'm trying to get something out of my education and live life and actually be somebody in life.
And what scares you the most about them coming and making such big cuts? What does that mean to you? How does that hurt you or the people around you personally?
Well, what hurts me the most is that I'm not going to be able to actually go to college. And one of the things is that I'm not going to be able to earn like more. One important thing is that I'm not going to have like enough money and to go to college. And going to college for me is it's been my dream, you know. And
what would you like to study?
I would like to study art and the engineering and architecture. And it seems to be, for now, it seems to be impossible for me to go, because they're cutting the government is not gonna give me my money, and I have to put money out of my pocket, and that for me is like thinking that I'm not gonna have like enough money to actually go to school, and I mean that's my dream.
Engineering and architecture, huh?
Yes.
Bridges or buildings?
Well, I was thinking on doing on actual buildings, but bridges seems to be a little more interesting.
Well, we could use some bridges in this world to connect us in ways that we haven't been able to figure out yet. I want to thank you very much. What grade are you in?
I'm in the 12th grade.
In the 12th grade?
Yeah.
All right. And maybe you guys can switch seats now, and let me ask you to move up to the microphone and tell us, really come on close, and tell us who you are and what school you're from.
My name is Ezra, and I attend Mandela High School at Fremont Federation. If the question is, what are we doing as of tomorrow? Well, we're going around. We started today. Yeah, we started organizing like a couple weeks ago, and then today we actually went around in classroom by classroom, telling students what are we doing tomorrow, what time are we marching, why are we doing it. First of all, we're marching because they're cutting down the budget for education. You know, we're losing a lot of money. They're cutting $39 billion this year all over California, so that means we're gonna lose after school programs. We're going to lose our tutoring. We're going to lose teachers. That's putting a big barrier on our way to college and to success for the rest of our lives, you know. But, you know, this means that we're gonna lose a lot of stuff. An example is that the we're at Fremont Federation, there's four schools. There's media, Paul Robertson, architecture, and Mandela. Paul Robertson is being shut down this year just because their test scores were low, and the administration decided we're cutting this school down. That's it. Well, is that really the solution? No, I don't think it is, because they could have given more support, more money, more teachers, more people that are willing to put the effort into the students and believe in them that they can succeed.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. This is a speak out. Tomorrow in California, from one end of this very large state to the other, there are going to be protests. Protests against the massive budget cuts that are happening from K through college. There's going to be great suffering. Of course, as always, the poor and the working class and the young people suffer. But of course, ultimately, the society and the culture suffers in the deepest way because we, you know, we demonstrate a disrespect for our children, and we need to understand that they are our future now. Well, are you interested in going to college?
Yeah, I'm very much interested in going to college. I want to succeed. I want to improve myself, because in my family, I'm the first one to go to ever graduate from high school and to go to college. I'm the person right now in all the history of my family that has ever achieved the highest education. And this is very important to me. I want to set the bar pretty high for my upcoming people, you know.
What would you like to do?
I would like to study art. I'm a big fan of drawing, you know. I love art. That's all I can say. I just love it.
Well, what would the school of the future that you drew look like?
What would it look like?
Yeah.
It would look like a teacher's where they put the little spark in the student that they can achieve anything they set their minds to. That's like the perfect school. That's like the principle. Because, you know, where there's a will, there's a way. And that, like my teacher says, that should be the rule.
Other people are here. Why don't you tell us what your name is, where you're in school, and what's your concern now? What are you afraid of based on these cuts?
My name is Kimberly. I'm 16 years old. I go to Mandela, one of the schools in the Fremont Federation. And well, one of my concerns with this budget cuts is that many of the students going to, Ezra said, we go to Fremont and then one of our schools right there is getting shut down. That is not the solution for the rest of the students. They could instead put more tutors so that they could help us. Next year with the budget cuts, if right now we hardly have any tutors, next year we won't have any. And then that's going to make them, like the schools like Mandela are going to be overcrowded even more. There's already about 30 students in every classroom. Not every student is able to get help from the teacher because there are so many students in a classroom. The teacher can't get to every single student. After the student is there for so much time, they get frustrated. And now with more students coming into every school, that's even worse because you don't get as much attention as you need. If you have any questions, the teacher sometimes doesn't have time to get to you. And sometimes we have to go after school with the tutors to get help because we can receive that help already in school with the teachers in the classroom. And then, so tutors are really a big help. And then next year we won't be able to have any tutors at our school because we're not able to pay them or anything. So that's something that's affecting us. And then going to college, already 250,000 students weren't able to go to colleges this year, right? Because of the budget cuts. Yeah. And then they weren't able because of the overcrowding, because there wasn't enough space because of the funding. So I think that that's cutting down students on the opportunity to go into school, to go into college after high school, and to actually becoming a better person in life, helping society.
How would you like to help society?
I want to go to college, and I have a dream, and that is I want to reach my goal, that I want to become a lawyer and someday be able to help out, give back to my community, and be able.
What kind of lawyer? What would you like to do with that?
I want to be an immigration lawyer.
Why?
Because I like helping people, and I see that this is a good way to help people and be able to allow them to get away, getting a better life and stuff.
And being protected.
Yeah.
Getting the full protection of the law, huh?
Yeah.
You are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. I find this conversation very moving. And it's always amazing to see the spirit and how much we could do if we had incredible schools, because we certainly have the kids who want a great deal from the education and want to do well by all of us. So there is a major struggle happening tomorrow, and let's see if we can get a teacher back in here. Also joining us is Randall
Bustamante.
You're a high school teacher here with some of these students at Mandela High, but you've been looking at this as a teacher. You've been trying to understand the implications, the dramatic implications of these kinds of cuts. Why don't you talk about your concerns just very practically as a teacher facing this on a day-to-day basis?
On the ground, what we see is less money for poorer schools. Now, everyone's hit by this economy, but I'm just going to refer to a bumper sticker I saw, which is, "A war in Afghanistan leaves every child behind." And what that means is that the money spent bailing out banks going to war is not being spent on smaller classes, on extra help. Kids talked about tutoring. It's meaning schools, like I know one school at our campus is losing two teachers. We are small schools. If you take away two teachers, you go from classes that are 25 to about 40. There's no way to account for that. So when there's 40 kids in a class, 30 kids in a class compared to 15, kids get disinterested. They drop out. When a kid drops out, they do something they shouldn't be doing sometimes. We see more prisons filling up and schools emptying. Aside from that, with 200, 250,000 seats missing from community college, you can't even encourage a kid to go to college to improve their life. So it's sending a message of hopelessness when there doesn't have to be. And so I think when kids talk about marching, I become hopeful that they feel they can do something about their future and change the way the direction education is going in.
If you had some input at that higher level, what are the kinds of things you would tell people who are in charge of structuring this system? What do you see at ground zero that they need to know?
At ground zero, I see a lot of people who really want to make a difference in their own lives. And what I see at the top is there's a lot of finger pointing at education, as in schools need to get their act together. I'm sorry. Our funding has been cut for the last 30 years. Prop 13 has reversed the direction of California. We've gone from number one to number 47. And so if you follow the money, we've gotten less and less. And who rises to the top when they've had everything, every advantage and every support taken away? So I would say to them, if your priority really is future, you have to invest in schools, in children, in support, and it's bigger than a school. The problems that we see in school are symptomatic of the entire community. So if we really want to turn things around, we have to fund health, we have to fund schools, we have to provide jobs at the bottom level, not just for people at the top.
That's Randall Bustamante, teacher at Mandela High School. Final comments. Remind us who you are and what words you want to leave us with.
Hi. This is Esdras again. I just want to say one last thing. Well, if you're hearing this, and whether you're a student, a teacher, a parent, or a worker in the in administration, or just a random person that's hearing this, just wanted to let you know that you can help us tomorrow. You can help us tomorrow by coming
down
and support.
How can people help you?
Coming down and show support. We're meeting down at Fruitvale Bar Station in East Oakland, and just come here. If you have a son that attends high school or college or whatever, just come down there and show that you care. If you care, we will be waiting for you.
We'll be waiting in Ogawa Plaza in downtown Oakland.
And that's UC Berkeley and San Francisco State. Last words?
I just want to remind everyone that the most direct way to create change is through direct action. Historically, that's always been the way. So I'm really inspired to see all these kids directly taking hold of their futures and directly changing it.
Beautiful. And 1 minute left. Final burst of energy.
There will also be a demonstration in Sacramento at 11 a.m. called Educate the State, and also at SF Civic Center at 5 p.m.
$50,000 for an inmate is not fair compared to $5,000 for a student. We need to change our priorities and spend the money in the right places.
This is Kevin right here, and one thing I want to let you know is that the future is in the kids. The future is in our hands, okay? So don't worry about people telling us that we're not able to go to college. We can't go to college if you believe it.
Well, I want to thank all of you for coming in here. I want to thank Carla West for producing this for Flashpoints. Beautiful job, Carla. Thank all the folks on Flashpoints. Really an honor to have you in here, to be able to open this dialogue. I say open because the door is open here for you all to come back and to continue this discussion. Please stay in touch. In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We continue our reporting from occupied Palestine, where our senior producer, Nora Bowes-Friedman, is standing by. She'll be there for the next month reporting for you and for the Flashpoints audience from ground zero in this occupied country. Nora, welcome back to Flashpoints. Good to have you with us. I know that one of the major parts of your visit and the reason for your visit is to investigate what's happening with children and how children are being not only affected, but arrested and brutalized. I know you're on a story today. Tell us about what happened with a 10-year-old and a 12-year-old.
Well, yeah. Hi, Dennis. It's good to be back. And, you know, a couple days ago on the show, I was telling you and the audience about my former student, who's 16 years old, 17 years old, and was arrested in the middle of the night and taken to prison for a year. Today, I'm, you know, kind of, I've been continuing that thread of that storyline, and actually a story that came out this week in Palestine was that on Sunday, I believe it was, the Israeli military arrested two young boys from Halil, from Hebron, in the southern occupied West Bank. They were playing near the Ibrahimi Mosque, and the army was there. There were, you know, a large group of right-wing, ultra-Orthodox Jewish settlers there, kind of intimidating the local Palestinians in the area. And the two boys were throwing stones, as is very common in this part of the world. And as I mentioned a few days ago, throwing stones is considered, it's kind of akin to a federal offense, according to the Israeli military, and it carries a heavy fine and imprisonment. You can get up to 10 years in prison if you're a child. The Israeli military took these two boys, one was 10 and his brother was 12, the 12-year-old remains in jail. As of now, he has a court date on Sunday, and he's at Ofra prison, where my student, a couple days ago when I was talking about him, he was held for about 9 months. The 10-year-old was taken to inside one of the settlement colonies inside Hebron called Kiryat Arba, where he was blindfolded and handcuffed and forced to sit on the chair for about 8 to 10 hours. He couldn't really tell how much time had passed because, of course, there's no clocks, and the Israeli soldiers wouldn't let him.
This is the 10-year-old.
This is the 10-year-old child, this little child, 10 years old. He still, you know, has wobbly teeth. You know, he's still getting teeth. He's a child. I mean, a kid.
And just to be clear, you interviewed him. You went to the family and you interviewed him.
Yeah, and I interviewed him and his mother and father. He was held there for about 8 to 10 hours. They, as I said, they handcuffed him, they blindfolded him, they terrorized him. I asked him if they had beaten him, and he said no, but they were shouting it. They're shouting a lot. They were, you know, insulting him and his family. They were just terrifying him. They put a dog, a large German Shepherd, right next to him as he was blindfolded and handcuffed. And They would provoke the dog into barking, which, you know, terrified the child even more. He wet himself. He was extremely frightened. The Israeli military wouldn't tell him, really where he was or how long he was going to be there. Finally, the mother and father found out through some neighbors who saw it happen that he and his brother were at this Kiryat Arba settlement detention center. And the father actually managed at about 11 o'clock at night to come and retrieve his child and take him back home. The 12-year-old, as I said, is still in prison. He has a court date on Sunday. But there was kind of a hearing a couple days ago, maybe yesterday, and the Israeli lawyer, human rights lawyer, who works on cases specifically for Palestinian children who are arrested by the Israeli military, she said that, she was at the hearing, and just to prove a point that there was a child, the 12-year-old was very nervous and of course terrified, and she dug through her bag and she pulled out a red balloon and she blew up the balloon and gave the balloon to the kid, and the kid was playing with it. And it was such an act of proving that this kid was a kid, that the Israeli military had arrested and terrified a child. Apparently the judge in the hearing was so ashamed. There are cameras around. He was ashamed to be there. That's what the parents said. But still, the child was sent to prison, and he remains there today. And when I was talking to the parents and the little boy, the 10-year-old, his younger brother, about what had happened, it was just, unbearable. This kid, he was a carefree kid last week, playing all the time. He was up on the roof playing. He would, be out in the streets playing with his friends. And apparently now he doesn't even want to go to school. He doesn't want to go visit anybody. He doesn't want to leave the house. He's extremely terrified of the settlers and the soldiers who are just outside. This family lives in the old city, which has been brutalized and terrorized by these extremist, violent settler groups who are just becoming more and more empowered by this Netanyahu administration.
Just explain, you refer to the old city, just set the scene.
The old city of Hebron is, it's one of the places in the West Bank, one of the only places actually in the West Bank where settlers have set up their colonies inside a Palestinian city. Most of the settlement colonies in the West Bank are, kind of outside on top of hills, in open spaces, on the edge of villages, which they eat up to expand their colonies. But this one, the Hebron settlement colonies are inside the actual Palestinian villages. And of course, this is the same scenario that's repeated in occupied East Jerusalem, where the settlement colonies are forever expanding inside Palestinian neighborhoods and villages. The old city is where, in 1994, a right-wing settler opened fire inside the Ibrahimi Mosque, killing 29 Palestinians. The old city is where the city has been effectively split into two parts, where Palestinians are forced into one enclave while the settler groups have full reign of most of the old city, where they're protected by the Israeli military soldiers. And they, every time the settlers want to hold a rally, the military shuts off part of the city to protect them. Every time the settlers want to move into someone's house and take it over, the Israeli military protects them. This is an extremely violent and unbelievable part of the West Bank. It's a microcosm of the entire situation, of course, but especially in Hebron, it's extremely dangerous for Palestinians to just wake up in the morning.
All right, let me jump in here. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. That's the voice of Nora Barros-Friedman. She's a senior producer on this show called Flashpoints. It's your daily investigative news magazine. Nora is in the region in occupied Palestine for a month. She had a piece come out just yesterday on the electronic intifada.net. I can't live without this place. Beautiful piece, Nora, and I'm going to talk to you about that in one moment. But now coming back to this family, the 12-year-old is still in jail with the balloon, the red balloon there. The 10-year-old is traumatized. So now say something about how this impacts on the family and where they go from here? How do they figure out if they'll ever see their 12-year-old again, or if he's going to be like tortured for 12 months?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, that's the thing. Everything is very arbitrary. Everything is indefinite. Everything is kind of up in the air in terms of where they go from here. Most likely, because of the attention, the media attention focused on this particular story, the 12-year-old will be released on Sunday. But, you know, it doesn't stop there. Once the cameras are turned off, once the news media, you know, turns to the next, you know, headline, the trauma doesn't stop. You know, I was talking to this family, the mother in particular, about how this impacts her and her children and, you know, what her biggest concerns are for their future. And she said, you know, it's something that she didn't think she would have to deal with. But of course, you know, it as a normal human being, as a normal parent, it's something that, of course, is the most disempowering. It's the most vicious form of daily experience here, and it's something that no mother, no father, no child should ever have to endure. But yet, this happens on a daily basis. It's very regular. And she said, you know, it might happen again. I mean, she basically echoed the mother that I spoke to a few days ago, you know, the mother of the 16, 17-year-old kid who's in jail for a year. She said, look, this is part of the life here. There's nothing that we can do. There's no recourse. There's no legal way to protect our children. It's up to the international community. It's up to people all over the world to figure out what's going on and stop it. It's up to the United Nations and the International Criminal Court to take the Israeli officials who make these just draconian and disgusting military laws possible. It's up to them to take these people to court and prosecute them. This is a clear violation of not only the Geneva Conventions, but the United Nations Conventions on the Rights of the Child. And even this is a violation of even the Israeli military law itself, which says that that children under 12 can't be arrested, they can't be held for any amount of time. So the Israeli military even broke their own rules in arresting and torturing and detaining this child, this 10-year-old child. And this is, you know, this is not a new story. This is not an anomaly. This is not something that's just going to happen once and never happen again. This is going to happen again and again until someone stops it. And that is the most atrocious part of this whole thing, is that this trauma, this collective trauma, this personal trauma, will happen again and again and again to the same family, to the same community, to the same population of people here under occupied military apartheid rule here in Palestine.
Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, speaking with Nora Barris Friedman on the ground in the occupied West Bank, illegally occupied. We never hear about that word in this context. It's extraordinary. One of the key censored stories of our time, but this is a story that we've chosen to cover, and Nora has thrown her whole life into it. Nora, we just have a minute left, but I want to talk to you about the story that appears on electronicintifada.net. Tell us about what you tried to do there. Tell us about how it got the name "I Can't Live Without This Place."
Well, this is a story, my first story for Electronic Intifada, you know, this time around. This is a story about the current and ongoing ethnic cleansing that's happening here, the expansion of these settlement colonies on Palestinian land, the expansion of home demolitions, the expansion of Israeli military laws that are racist and apartheid in nature. This is a story about a man whose father and grandfather and many generations before them were born in this little tiny village called Al-Walija. Al-Walija, I think I explained a couple days ago, was ethnically cleansed beginning in 1948 when Israel stole two-thirds of the village land and turned it into two settlements, Gilo and Har Gilo. And now the settlement the settler community, if you want to call it that, backed by a private company, which develops settlement colonies, are trying to build a settlement on this last third of the remaining land of El Huilliche. They want to call it Givat Yael, and they want to put 45,000 Jewish Israelis into that settlement, and they eventually want to connect these three settlements, Gilo, Har Gilo, and Givat Yael, to the Gush Etzion settlement block, which is one of the largest in the Bethlehem Hebron area. And this man decided 15 years ago, most of the population of El Huilliche is either passed away, or the descendants are now in Dehesha refugee camp, which is right here in Bethlehem. He decided 15 years ago that he wasn't going to be a refugee anymore, and he found his way back to El Huilliche, which is actually just about a 10-minute drive from Bethlehem, through the woods. It's on a beautiful hillside that overlooks Jerusalem. And because Israeli military law forbids any home building by Palestinians on their village lands, if any home is built or even expanded or, fixed up, renovated, they come and destroy it. It's part of, they just prohibit any growth in this zone, because they want to expand these settlements into it and take more and more land, which is, the policy here. So he came about 15 years ago and set himself up inside a cave, a 4,000-year-old cave, and he's been planting all sorts of fruits and vegetables. He has a chicken coop and rabbits, and he talked about his story. He talked about his rights to this land. He actually went to Israeli court to prove that this land was his from generations and generations ago. The Israeli court couldn't deny that. He had, papers from the Ottoman Empire, from the British Mandate period, from the Jordanian administration, and then finally from the Israeli administration as well, proving that this was his land, with all these documents and ID cards and everything. And he's been living there, and he's living alone. His family lives in Dehesha camp still. His family, his friends, his colleagues are all here in Bethlehem. But he's alone on this hillside, this beautiful hillside, and he actually loves it. He said in the story, I couldn't live without this place. I come here every I'm here every day. I plant something new every day. When sometimes he goes back to see his family in Dehesha, and he stays for a night or two, and he said that every time he sleeps over there, all he dreams about is his land, and he can't wait to get back to it. Settlers have come and tried to bribe him with millions of dollars in bribe money to get him to leave, and he's refused time and time again. He's faced attacks, he's faced detention, he's faced arrests. He gets brought to the nearby checkpoint every once in a while and put in detention and then released, and then he goes back to his land. I mean, it's this ongoing tumultuous story, but the resilience and the capacity that he has to stay where his family was born, where his roots are from, is unwavering. And so that's the story that I wrote for Electronic Intifada.
And that's the story today from Nora Barros-Friedman in Bethlehem, reporting for Flashpoint. She is the senior producer for this show, seventh year in a row, where she's been on the ground for us, reporting, working with young people. All of this is crucial. We look forward to more of the reporting you're going to do on young people and the general situation there. Nora, you're doing a great job. Please be careful, and we'll talk to you really soon.
Great. Thanks, Dennis.
You've been listening to The Best of Flashpoints for the week of March 1st, 2010. For more information, you can go to flashpoints.net. This has been a production of Pacifica Radio. For Flashpoints, I'm Sabrina Jacobs.